On the internet, and I'll apologize, we're getting started just a little bit late. This is the Public Utilities Commission meeting for today. This is the time and place that's been noticed for the May 19th meeting. I'm Commissioner Dusty Johnson, and joining me today are my colleagues Steve Kolbeck and Gary Hansen. We're getting started just a little bit late today because I forgot the most important part of the meeting downstairs, and I had to make a run down there. But, you know, when the Book of Good Deeds is written, it'll note that a lot of people in the world, or at least in our little sphere, probably cared who the commissioners were or how the political winds were blowing. But one person who's worked here for 25 years didn't get caught up in all that business. He just cared about showing up at the office every day and trying to find the right answer, not right to what he thought one commissioner wanted, but right as to what was in the public interest. And for 25 years, he's had to put up with our garbage and done a very good job. And so with that, ladies and gentlemen, I would ask that you join me in recognizing the accomplishments and the 25-year tenure of an analyst, Mr. Dave Jacobson. Did you want equal time, Mr. Jacobson?
No, I would just hope that I can continue to serve for a while.
Well, I'm glad we've been able to hold on a day for 25 years, and I am glad that I didn't have a heart attack making that second run up the stairs. I am struggling just a little bit, so we'll see how that goes. But with that, we're going to move the agenda around a little bit. Our first docket we'll take will be TC09-019, but prior to that, let's go ahead and deal with some of our administrative matters. The minutes for the meeting held on March 24th have been circulated. Are there any corrections or amendments? Hearing none, is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Motion has been made. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, we'll receive an update from Ms. Gregg on our consumer inquiries and complaints.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. The Commission has received a total of 96 contacts since the last report was prepared for the May 5th, 2009 Commission meeting. 25 of the contacts involved telecommunication service, 21 of the contacts involved electric service, 6 contacts involved natural gas service, 2 contacts involved gas and electric service, 10 contacts involved cell phone service, 23 contacts related to the Do Not Call registry, 1 contact involved the Grain Warehouse Division, and 8 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 1,038 of the 1,108 complaints received in 2009 have been resolved, and 2,512 of 2,513 complaints received in 2008 have been resolved.
Thanks very much. Any questions for Ms. Gregg? Hearing none, thank you. And I should have checked to see if any of my colleagues have any objection to moving around the agenda. And if there aren't any, we'll proceed with TC09-019, which does deal with a filing made by Mid-States Communications and Native American Telecom for an interconnection agreement. Ms. Rogers.
Good morning, Chairman Johnson and members of the Commission. My name is Darla Pullman Rogers, and I represent Mid-State Communications in this docket. We, by way of background, entered into negotiations with Native American Telecom in the October timeframe. We started out looking at what they submitted was called a traffic exchange agreement. We moved from there through several drafts of an interconnection agreement, and I'm happy to file and present to you the agreement that you see before you, and both parties have, through negotiations, agreed to the terms and conditions contained in this agreement, and we would respectfully request you to approve the interconnection agreement between Mid-State Communications and Native American Telecom. Thank you, and if you have any questions, we'll try to answer them.
Great. Anything additional from Native American Telecom?
No. Dallas summarized it quite well, so that's nothing else to add.
Great. Thanks very much, Mr. Jordy. Any other comments from – oh, we should look to staff.
Staff does recommend approval of the agreement. Everything about its filing and execution was proper. There's nothing about the substance and the language that was concerning to staff, and we simply recommend approval.
Thanks very much, Ms. Semler. Any questions for any of the parties? Yes, Commissioner Colbeck.
I have one for Native American Telephone. If we have a interconnection agreement and you do not have a COA, are you planning on offering any services in South Dakota that would require you to have a COA?
Native American Telecom was granted authority by the tribal council to provide services just on the reservation of Crow Creek. So it was authorized by the Tribal Utilities Commission there to provide services on the reservation, and we would be limiting service to just on the reservation.
Okay, so you have no plans of going outside the reservation to offer dial tone?
That's correct.
All right, thank you.
Other questions?
Finally, Mr. Chairman, this is for Native American as well. Do you plan to offer services to non-tribal members?
At this time, we're planning to provide service just to tribal members.
All right. And have you made any application on a federal level at all?
No. At this time, there's really no applications that we've identified that would be required unless we subsequently decide to obtain ETC status, and then if the service is limited to the reservation, I believe we would need to go to the FCC for that. But other than that, there's really no applications that are required at the federal level.
Thank you.
Other questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
I'll move in TC09-019 that the Commission approve the interconnection agreement.
Any discussion on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Oh, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, as long as there, my vote is going to be in favor of this, but I'm voting in favor on the premise that they are not providing the services to non-tribal members.
Yeah, well said. Any further comments? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much. With that, we'll turn back toward the electric portion of our agenda, dealing with electric item number one, which does deal with a filing made by Northwestern for approval of tariff revisions. And Mr. Decker, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. Jeff Decker with Northwestern Energy. Visit with you a few minutes about tankless water heaters. We've had a few requests for tankless water heaters to be installed on our system, and they kind of bring with them some new things that we're dealing with the tankless water heaters. What we've done with this filing on rates 15, 23, and 25, we've included language to exclude tankless water heaters. The water heaters are part of the qualifier for these particular rates, and a regular water heater, just for your information, a regular tank water heater in a home usually runs about 5,000 watts or 5 kW. The tankless waters run between, you can get the small ones, but the ones we've seen between 15 and 25 kW. So on these particular rates, we just didn't feel it made sense to reward with a discount increasing the demand by 10 to 20 kW. That's part of the reason why we want to exclude tankless water heaters on those particular rates. Also, what we've done with the general terms is we've included some language in the general terms that says if a residential customer wants to have a tankless water heater installed on their system, that they may be responsible for the upgrade costs in order to serve that customer. The costs may range up to $3,000 to upgrade the line and the transformer in order to be able to handle that load without those upgrades. In some instances, may cause blinking lights for that customer or neighboring customers. So we're just trying to put some language in the tariff to adjust tankless water heaters. We would request your approval of these changes.
Thanks very much. Staff, any comments? Mr. Jacobson, Ms. LaBrie Baker, and Ms. Kramer.
Thank you, Chairman. This is Terry LaBrie Baker with staff.
Northwestern has filed its proposed tariff changes per our administrative rules. Staff doesn't object to any of the changes. There were no interveners in the matter, and staff would recommend approving the proposed changes with the proposed effective date of June 1st.
Thanks very much. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Decker, could you tell us a little bit more about the tankless water heaters? We've heard so much about them as being a conservation device, and I was not aware that they absorb quite so much electricity, and apparently so much so that the transformers actually have to be upgraded in the neighborhood in order to prohibit or to stop lights from flickering, you say?
Possibly not in all cases, but in several. One of the guys went out and looked at an instance yesterday, and in that instance as well, there would need to be an upgrade. There was one instance a couple of months ago that was brought forth as a complaint that we dealt with. That one would have required, I think it was about $2,700 of upgrade costs. So it's not in all situations, but possibly in many. If you look at the regular water heater is 5 kW and you're upgrading to 25, I mean, the system was built with that in mind. And a lot of the tariff language talks about 5 kW, not just Northwestern tariffs, but other companies' tariffs as well. So that must have kind of been a standard. And all of a sudden, if you increase that by 20, it's a bigger load. The average house runs about 15 to 25 kW for its existing appliances and whatnot, excluding electric heat. So all of a sudden, if you double that, you're really hitting the demand.
It's like switching on an entire home at all at one with one switch.
Yeah.
For how long a period does the water heater use that? Do you know?
Well, my understanding would be if it's a 20 kW that when you're running the shower, if you're running the dishwasher, if you're running the washing machine and hot water is being called for, that 20 kW would be utilized. And I guess the selling point of them is that they're not heating water when you're not using it. Maybe the downside is when you need to instantly have that hot water, that takes a lot of energy to get that hot water right now.
If it were necessary to place these types of, or I shouldn't say necessary, if a number of homes in a neighborhood decided to put in tankless water heaters, would you have to yet upgrade additionally for your transformer? If you went through the process of upgrading for one home and all of a sudden you had four or five in the neighborhood with tankless water heaters, what challenge would that present?
I would imagine it would depend upon how much we upgraded, how highly we upgraded that transformer at that time. You know, would we upgrade it for a single step or for two or three steps would probably be the determination. But, yeah, if you had, let's just say, five homes on a transformer and all of a sudden you added 100 kW for water heating, that may require quite an upgrade. I'm not sure what the dollars would be on that.
If I'm asking beyond your scope, please let me know. I'm just asking for information. I probably shouldn't waste everybody's time, but I thought there might be some value to it at this juncture. One last question, that is there a potential in that last situation that the line coming into the transformer would not be able to carry enough amps or electrons for the facility? If that's beyond your scope, just say so. But I'm just curious.
I probably shouldn't comment on that. I mean, we can build to whatever they want, but I guess I'm not sure how big those lines are that serves every home, if in every instance that would require a change or not.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Mr. Decker, on page, I think it's sheet number 1B of your tariff filing underneath the residential water heater restriction. If you go to the last sentence there under residential, it says tankless water heaters are permitted only with prior approval of Northwestern and may require a contribution in aid of construction for required system upgrades. Does that mean that if you still have control over that, even if they decide to put in the upgrades? So you're saying that a customer cannot put in a wireless or a tankless water heater only unless you approve it. Is that correct?
If they make us aware that they're putting it in. And that's always a control issue. They don't always make us aware of that.
Okay.
But obviously when they do, and if we see that an upgrade is required, I mean, then we can charge the customer who's causing that cost. But that can be a problem because, you know, they're not required to make us know that.
Okay. And what would the prior approvals consist of?
Mostly what we do is just have engineering go out and take a look at, is that upgrade required? Is the customer willing to pay for that upgrade? And is it going to harm any other part of the system? So it would mostly be a combination of regulatory and operations doing that approval.
Okay. So I guess I'm a little leery about approving the tariff and then having them only be able to install it if you say it's okay. But even if they desire to put in the proper upgrades. Is there anything that you can put my mind at ease on that for?
Am I
reading too far into it? Or
if they're willing to put in those upgrades, we'll install it.
Okay.
And that's the reason for it. We just want to have language in there saying that, you know, if there's a $3,000 upgrade needed, that's the customer that should probably be responsible for that. And if they're willing to pay that, we're willing to do the upgrade and let them put that water heater in.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, that's the policy, Northwestern. Commissioner Colbeck, I wonder if your mind couldn't be at ease a little bit more if we had the tariff reflect what Mr. Decker just said. I mean, something about rather than prior approval, prior notification of Northwestern, and then include that Northwestern may condition, may require contribution and aid of construction for required system upgrades. I mean, I don't think it'd take many words to tweak to have this say what you just said. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's fine. It wouldn't put any additional burden. It's just stating what we're doing.
Yeah, sure. Because it's just a nit, but, you know, when you start saying, I mean, I understand that the cost causer should be the cost payer, but then let's make this say that rather than say Northwestern's got ultimate approval of, you know, what appliances or equipment you're putting in your house. So I don't know if we want to do the wordsmithing here, probably not, but maybe just work with staff and our approval would be contingent upon that sort of two-step notification and ability to condition.
Okay, so, sure.
I mean, the demand numbers you're talking about are really, I mean, they are impressive. I mean, these are quite the pieces of equipment. It's as much as a house, and yet, do we have that much of a need for transformer upgrades when in a neighborhood you just add one more house? And if that's all it is, I mean, how often have upgrades really been necessary?
We've really only seen tankless water heaters approach just a couple of times. And so, but in both those instances, we've seen an upgrade needed. And especially probably in the line going to the house. It depends too, is it in a new area or an older area, and how big was the line? You know, if it was installed 30 years ago, it probably didn't contemplate the loads that we have today. So it's depends on the particular situation.
So might there be people that invested in a tankless water heater because they knew that they could be on this preferential rate from Northwestern, and now we're sort of changing their payback calculations?
I don't know that situation is out there. I'm only aware of one tankless water heater on the system. Maybe there's others. I don't know. But rate 15, I think we've only got maybe 4 to 6 customers on that rate, and usually it's for electric heat, not for water heating.
Sure.
The rate 23 is a water heating rate. I don't know that we've added anybody to that for quite some time. And rate 25, most people come onto that rate because of electric heat, not water heating.
Yeah, that does make me feel better. You just hate for people to make investments and then change the rules of engagement, so to speak, after the fact. We're dealing with a very small N here.
So. I'm not aware of that, you know, customers in that situation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And effective date of June 1st, I think staff mentioned, and that's Northwestern's comfortable with that?
We're fine with that.
Okay. Great. Any further questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'm just a little bit curious. I unfortunately am a do-it-yourselfer in many respects. I don't know enough about these to
to install one. I understand some can go on the outside, but it depends on the type of climate where you live and et cetera. Is this the type of situation where a homeowner might purchase one and try and install it themselves and then find out later on that they have to pay for upgrades and all that sort of thing?
That could be a possibility if they would go out and purchase the unit and then have an electrician come and determine that they needed an upgrade. That may be the case.
Are you going to be doing any type of education process, flyer, and just to give people somewhat of a heads up?
I don't know that we had a plan to do that because of the small amount of times that it takes place, but it sure is something. We could put a flyer and put a bill stuffer in, or we'll get some information out so people are aware of that.
I think this commission would appreciate you doing that. It might help help. Excuse me. It might help someone from going through some a real terrible surprise, all that they have to spend $2,000 or $3,000 all of a sudden. Thank you.
I'll piggyback one more step. I think a bill stuffer is a good idea, particularly let people know of the change. But on a go-forward basis, that's maybe not the best educational. I mean, you know, you're going to have to be talking to people about this for the rest, as long as this tariff is still in effect. Do you have a very good relationship with vendors? I mean, that's where you probably really need to have the information. Hey, make sure to call your utility company when you buy this.
And, you know, locally we can touch people, but there's probably so many places they can get a hold of these pieces of equipment that it's difficult to catch all of them. I mean, you can buy them off the internet, you can buy them at all the local supply stores and local building stores. You know, we can attempt that, and as contractors come in for training, we can attempt to make them aware. That's about the best we can do.
Sounds like there's too much leakage. Those service boundaries should be walls, not lines on a map, right? Yeah, thanks.
I have just one question for staff. Do we know of any other companies that have come in for this type of tariff revision?
No, I have. I'm not aware of anything that's happened. But, you know, I don't know how much promotion of tankless water heaters has actually taken place around South Dakota. But, you know, I do see some. But we haven't heard anything yet.
Okay, thanks.
The gas water heaters are probably maybe the better solution, and maybe a little more popular and kind of create less problems, and maybe that's what you see more of than the electric.
That's a good point. Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing none, any comments or action? I will move that the commission approve the tariff revisions with an effective date of June 1st. Any discussion on the motion?
With what we talked about earlier, revamping the residential line.
Yes. Good point, Commissioner Colbeck. Yeah, conditioned with some slightly revised wording on sheet 1B. Thanks. Anything else we missed there? Commissioner Hansen, did you want a bill stuffer?
No, I don't think that's appropriate for this type of. I was going to call it an ordinance.
Old habits die hard.
That's right.
Fine, then we'll proceed to any discussion on the pending motion. Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson won't sign. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks.
Thank you.
We'll proceed to the hydrocarbon pipeline portion of the agenda. Item number one does deal with the filing made by TransCanada for the Keystone XL project. The two questions before the commission today are, first, the first one we'll take up is, shall the commission grant intervention to requested parties? We've had a number of them. Let's see here. I think we started with Mary Jasper, Paul Siemens, Daryl Iverson, Carol Moyer, Glenn Iverson, Jacqueline Limpert, John Harder, Zona Vig, Craig Covey, as chairman of the Tripp County Water User District, Caitlin Collier, representing Dakota Rural Action, and David Nemi. I don't think I've missed anybody. With that, we'll pause and see if any of those people who are requesting party status wish to make any comment. Any comment?
Chairman,
go ahead.
And
I am appearing for Dakota Rural Action, and David Nemi. With me is Paul Blackburn, who's associated with my office and is appearing pro hac vici, and I would like to turn it over to him.
Okay, proceed.
In terms of our interventions, we don't have intervention. We don't have any particular comments at the time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other persons requesting party status wish to make comment? Any others? Okay. Does the applicant have any comments?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. Brett Kennecke appearing for TransCanada Keystone Pipeline this morning. We have no objection to any of the interventions listed on today's agenda. Thank you.
I should note that I think I omitted Lon Lyman from my list of interveners. And if I didn't mention anybody else, we're taking up sort of all intervention requests at the same time. So if anybody wants to deal with them separately for particular reasons, please speak up. All right. Here we'll look to staff. Any comments from Canadal, Solem, Splitsosher, Binder, or Semler?
This is Kara Semler for staff. Staff supports granting all petitions to intervene.
Thank you very much. And also Deborah Nemi, I missed that one as well. Any questions by commissioners or advisors? Okay, hearing none, any comments or action?
I move that the commission grant the interventions.
Motion has been made. Any discussion on the pending motion? And I think the deadline was May 11th, is that right? And so I would just note that there were a couple of late-filed interventions that are a part of this motion. Any further comments on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, the second question for HP09-001 is, shall the commission grant the motion for extension of time to file application for party status? Believe Dakota Rural Action is the movement. Would you like to proceed?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Dakota Rural Action has a number of members that have expressed concerns about the commission's procedures with regard to its notice. Also, as I think many people are aware, during the course of the intervention period, the weather in north and western South Dakota was quite bad this year, and a number of landowners were not able to participate in the commission's public input hearings. For those reasons, we know that the commission changed its notice procedure this year compared to last year, and we believe there are a number of landowners who are quite confused about how this procedure has worked and how the changes worked. And I think it's telling that last year, up to the date of the first intervention deadline, there were 148 parties that intervened. And this year, there are, I believe, 11 that intervened through the intervention deadline, and two intervened afterwards. That's quite a big drop. And it's not to say that we believe that there should be a large number of interveners, but rather that the change in procedure in terms of the contents of the notice confused quite a number of landowners. And the people that my client has talked to are not aware of or not familiar with or aware of the procedures and are not necessarily aware of their rights under law to participate in the evidentiary hearings. So for those reasons, we believe that an extension of the deadline is appropriate, and we also request the commission investigate whether its notice in this proceeding was adequate, both under South Dakota statutory law and South Dakota Constitution, as well as the U.S. Constitution's due process requirements. And I think I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Blackburn. Applicant. I'm sorry, I'll pause. Mr. Kennecke, you'll go ahead, and then we'll take other interveners after you. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. We gently oppose this request. I mean, there are a number of factors that are different in this docket as opposed to the 2007 docket. While the pipeline is almost 30% longer through South Dakota, the the notice was essentially the same. The terms that the commissioners decided upon in 07 were then put in statute later on, as I understand it. We gave notice to almost 200 fewer landowners. This pipeline doesn't go through the city of Yankton, for example. There's just a number of factors that are different here with respect to the number of notices which went out to people. I don't really understand what the movement is talking about when they say changes in the notice structure, and you'll have to ask them for more about that. But it would be my thought that the commission has processes in place to deal with untimely interventions. And if there are indeed people out there who wish to intervene later on, we can take them along and pick them up at that time, deal with them appropriately, and then keep the docket moving forward in the interim. There's been almost a week between the timing of the movement's filing and today, and no additional one-page applications for intervention have come in. So it would be our position. Let's just move forward, and if people need to intervene in an untimely fashion, let's deal with them according to the commission rules at that time. Thank you.
Other individuals that have recently been granted party status, any comments? Any comments from other interveners? Hearing none, we'll look to staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Staff certainly has no standing objection of any sort to late filed interventions. I believe we have rules specifically on point that will provide the commission with enough guidance should we receive some late filed interventions. So I do not support an extension of the general time frame. With that being said, I don't doubt that late filed interventions will be accepted by the commission. You know, I applaud the efforts that Dakota Rural Action is making to protect its members, and it appears maybe the public at large. I would just really encourage it and the public in general to use the resources here in the commission. Staff takes its role very seriously. We're charged with the role of observing, researching, and protecting the public interest. That public interest certainly doesn't involve one individual landowner, but various facets that will go into the research of this project. We have experts on staff here, from pipeline safety to transmission. We awarded someone today for 25 years of service. We have experts on staff that can help with questions. And I'll speak for Karen Kramer and myself, the two staff attorneys. We can help with any procedural questions that may exist. We heard from Deb Gregg earlier, over 2,000 contacts in last year and over 1,000 this year, and we're not even 6 months into the year. None of them involve questions regarding this project. None of them involve questions regarding intervention, and I believe that is telling. In addition, staff will be hiring experts, a socioeconomic expert, a pipeline engineering expert, and an environmental expert. And although staff is charged with managing those experts and their work product, statutorily the applicant pays for that. It's an amazing resource we're able to offer through our siting statutes. And again, I encourage Dakota Rural Action, Dakota Plains Justice, and the public in general to use the resources that are built into our siting statute. I'm going to finish, commissioners, with some specific comments to the merits of the motion that was filed. I previously spoke to it, but I suppose we could take Dakota Rural Action's word for it that there's confused landowners, that they've received a number of inquiries, but the fact is we've received none. It's been in the paper, it's been on the news. I think the public in general knows the PUC is charged with citing this project, yet we've received no questions. Dakota Rural Action questions the notice given by the applicant, and all of the proof of service is filed in our docket. They're all up on our docket, and from my examination, the applicant has met its burden completely, and all of that is publicly filed. The Dakota Rural Action questions the notice provided by the commission and cites a statute intended for use in contested case hearings. The meetings we had were not contested case hearings. Rather, they're part of our siting laws structured under a completely different set of South Dakota code. We will send that notice out when we do have the contested case hearing. And a motion staff recently filed, we've asked for the commission to schedule that for the first week of November. So that notice is certainly coming in the not-so-distant future, really. I know the months will go fast. So with that, commissioners, staff does not support a general extension for the time frame for intervention. Rather, I believe our statutes and our rules are sufficient to examine those on a case-by-case basis. And although I don't find merit with any of Dakota Rural Action's arguments, I applaud its efforts, and I look forward to working with them as we are on the same team here to protect the public interest.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Semler. We'll open it up to Commissioner Advisor questions. Mr. Blackburn, Commissioner Johnson here. I did want to walk through your pleading a little bit. You know, in point four, you do raise the specter that adequate information to landowners about the hearing process has not been provided. So let's break this apart a little bit. With regard to SDCL 12617, in what way do you believe the commissioner, the applicant, is in violation?
Well, there are two different requirements that we see under the law for providing notice. One is the applicant has the notice requirement, which was modified by law last year, and that is the notice required under the Siting Act. And that's 4941B 5.2. And we understand that the legislature changed that so that the applicant in pipeline cases would have to provide notice as well. And so that the applicant sent out their letter noticing landowners pursuant to that statute. In addition, 12617, which is under the Administrative Procedures Act, South Dakota Administrative Procedures Act, contains the requirements for what is provided in notice and contested case hearings. And that last year, my understanding is that the commission sent out a letter to each landowner itself, not the applicant, and that letter also has to cover the notice of application, and the notice of application described the procedures, the pipeline, the facts of the situation in a fair amount of detail, and also the commission sent out an application form last year. This year, my understanding is that just the applicant sent out a letter, the commission sent no materials. If I'm incorrect about that, I'd like to know, but none of the landowners we've talked to a number of them, have seen anything but the applicant's letter.
So specific to my question about 12617, in what way is there, has that statute not been followed appropriately?
The content of the letter that the applicant sent, as I understand it, is a single one-page letter. That one-page letter included only, for example, it just said an underground pipeline in the affected area of the counties. That underground pipeline, it didn't say it was an oil pipeline. It didn't say the size of the pipeline. It didn't say whether it's going to be near people's property. Although affected area is described other places in law, the letter itself did not include any discussion of where the affected area is.
So, Mr. Blackburn, I'm sorry to interrupt, but again, I want to try to get specific because these are pretty significant. I mean, they're not so far as allegations, but you sort of cast a shadow of doubt, and I want to figure out if we really have done something inappropriate here. You said that the letter did not contain information specifically about what parcels were being passed through. Of those you mentioned, the two statutes, the Constitution of South Dakota and the Constitution of the United States, is that required?
The standard for providing notice in matters that affect constitutionally protected rights, such as landowners' property rights, the bottom line standard is contained in the U.S. Constitution or procedural due process. It doesn't matter if a state law does not comply with that minimal constitutional standard, state law itself is unconstitutional. The standard under the U.S. Constitution and the Supreme Court of South Dakota has adopted the standard is that notice must be reasonable in the circumstances, and that particularly means the kind of notice that somebody who wanted to truly inform landowners of their not only the pipeline project but also their legal rights under the law, kind of notice would be provided under law. And letter provided by TransCanada by itself does not comply those standards. Now, I understand that there's also been publication in newspapers, but all the courts have been very clear that publication in newspapers is not adequate when the property owners of record addresses are available. So that's publication by itself is supplementary and not adequate.
So, Mr. Blackburn, you alluded to the commission's earlier experience, and so I'll piggyback on that. With the first such pipeline filing we had, at least given my tenure on the commission, you know, the public meetings were very well attended, more than 100 people at each of them, east of the river, packed houses. We had the exact same experience with the meetings a few weeks ago. So I'm having a hard time thinking that the people in the area didn't know what was going on, that they had an opportunity to participate and have their voices heard. I mean, can you be any more specific about, you mentioned the word confusion three or four times. I'm not understanding how somebody could be confused about their ability to participate. And we haven't heard that confusion, at least that, according to staff. And if you've got people who said they've contacted the commission offices and haven't been helped by Ms. Gregg or anybody else, I mean, we want to know, certainly.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the standard here is not whether the result is not the standard. The standard is what's constitutionally required. So although to the appearance of the commission staff and the commissioners, there are people participating, when we're talking about taking away people's property rights, what we need to be concerned about is not just those who appear at public hearings but have the opportunity to do that, have the time to do that, but also the landowners of record may only have access to knowing what's going on in the commission through letters, for example, absentee landowners. So the result is not the standard. We talk about the result of the lack of people intervening to give a sense that things have changed compared to last year. And I don't agree with the applicant that the fewer number of landowners accounts for such a dramatic decrease in the participation of landowners in the intervention. But rather, the standard here is whether the commission has complied with the requirements of the U.S. and South Dakota constitutions. And we also disagree with staff that this is not a contested case hearing, and although we understand that providing notice 10 days before the evidentiary hearings may be interpreted that way, our belief is that contested case hearings begins with the first notice of application, when the notice of application is sent out, and that in order for landowners and other interveners to participate fully in this process, efforts start participating 10 days before the evidentiary hearing and have a reasonable opportunity to participate in those hearings.
You know, Mr. Blackburn, you know, we keep coming back to the number of interveners in a similarly filed docket compared to now. I mean, I don't know that matters. I mean, either proper notice is given or it hasn't been, but I mean, I guess I'll take the bait a little bit. I mean, are you aware of the 148 interveners in the last proceeding, how many of them called witnesses, cross-examined witnesses, or engaged in any cross-examination of witnesses, or rather participated in discovery?
We don't believe that's relevant to the situation here.
I don't believe it's relevant either, Mr. Blackburn, but if we're going to compare 148 to a smaller number as some sort of evidence that the Constitution of the United States hasn't been complied with, I mean, I want to examine that a little bit more.
to the extent that people participated last year, some of them in fact did, and I don't know how many, and I expect that you do understand how many people intervened last year. The question isn't whether the number of individuals who intervened is relevant or not. It's whether each individual landowner had their rights protected and had the rights provided for as by the Constitution. Those particular landowners who did in fact intervene had a right to intervene, and they did participate in the commission proceedings. And that the important point here is not whether, in general, how things worked out, but whether particular landowners had their rights protected to protect their property interests as required by the Constitution.
Well, I agree 100% with every word you just mentioned. I mean, I do think either proper notice is given or it isn't. I mean, I would just remind counsel that you advanced the argument that somehow notice must have been deficient because of the smaller number of interveners.
We mentioned that because it gives an indication that things have changed. Whether or not notice is deficient isn't because of the number of interveners who have been involved rather is evaluated based on what is reasonable notice in the circumstances, and the courts have actually quite a lot of case law about what has been, what amount of notice is required. And our understanding is that South Dakota Codified Law 126.17 was drafted particularly to comply with constitutional requirements. I believe it comes out of the American Bar Association model APA, and so it was drafted particularly to make sure that states complied with constitutional requirements. And 126.17 has quite a long list of things that are required in it, and I believe that the Commission's notice last year complied with that. If you go through the notice last year, you can check off everything that was required by 126.17.
So, Mr. Blackburn, you on page 2.6, you make a note that the Commission has liberal rules for intervention. I mean, given that and given the Commission's, you know, longstanding practice of granting any late-filed intervention that doesn't cause prejudice to another party, is there a reason that the Commission shouldn't take these on a case-by-case basis rather than making a blanket extension?
There's a difference between an extension and notice. Notice is required in order for people to even apply for intervention, they need to have proper notice. So whether or not the Commission has an ability to allow people to intervene later, those who have not received notice would not be in a position to even request late intervention. Therefore, whether the exact period of the intervention is not as important as providing adequate notice.
So who under state law or under the Constitution of the United States should have received notice to this point and has not? I mean, if we're going to allege that, I mean, I think it is a serious allegation that people who should have received notice have not. And I don't want to just let a comment go be made like that without some support. I mean, can you help me out?
It's not that people haven't received anything. Our understanding is the applicant sent a letter to each of the affected landowners. Our contention is that the contents of the notice were inadequate, that the applicant's letter was simply too vague and did not comply with either 126.17 or the constitutional requirements as described by a number of federal courts and the South Dakota Supreme Court.
So specifically, you know, Mr. and I'm really not trying to be difficult, but we're talking so much in generalities that this notice is deficient, and that is a big, big deal.
Right,
and so I would have been a little more comfortable if your pleading had addressed specific issues required by law or interpretational law in your mind that notice did not address. Do you have anything specific for me? Because this is a very big deal.
I understand that. And it's also important because if later on notice is found to be deficient by a court, then the commission's proceedings would be overturned.
The commission's fully aware of that fact. Can we get very specific?
Yes.
I mean, specifically what should have been on the four corners and wasn't.
What I would propose, we submitted our motion to extend to give the commission time to review and study this and requested the commission investigate it. What we could offer to do instead was we will present another motion to request formal renotice of the proceeding, and in that motion we'll provide a memorandum of support. And we'll provide our legal arguments and what we believe are the required notice requirements for the commission, and we would be happy to do that.
Well, you know, with regard to your request for the commission to investigate, I mean, at the very least, commission staff has. We heard from Ms. Semler that she has looked into it, and we heard the commissioners heard at least her opinion about whether or not state statutes and the Constitution of the United States have been properly followed. In the future, Mr. Blackburn, I do think it would be helpful if you're going to raise the specter of this sort of inadequacy that you help us out with some specificity, because you've alleged something that at least commission staff doesn't believe is so. Now, it doesn't mean commission staff is right. I'm just saying you put us in a position where I'm looking at the letter of the law and it appears as though it's been met. Any comments?
Well, we disagree that the letter of the law has been met, and as I said, our intention was to ask the commission for an extension and then to work with the commission cooperatively to resolve this matter. I think that the appropriate procedure for us now is to submit another motion to request renotice, and we will provide the legal arguments we have there, and then you can reconsider this matter at a future date. That's what we would suggest that the procedure should be here. So we actually did try to alert the commission to this issue and provide an opportunity for further discussion about it. So we're not trying to be evasive and we're not trying to be broad or general, but rather we thought to raise the issue and provide an opportunity for further communications about it, and I believe that's where we are.
Okay. Thanks very much. Well, I've hogged the mic a bit. Let's see if there are other questions.
Mr. Chairman, I have quite a few, but rather than going through that exercise, do I understand that Mr. Blackburn is going to – he's said twice now that he's going to present something different to us. Is he taking this off the table?
No, we're still requesting that the extension be included, allowed to allow landowners more time and for the commission to review notice issue, the issue related to the contents of the notice. So we would still request that the 30-day extension be provided, and during that time we would prepare a motion related to notice, and would be looking to engage with the commission in the discussion about that notice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I'll just save my my comments for if we're going to vote on this. I think you've covered it well, but I don't know whether I need to have Mr. Blackburn address my comments or not. I'll save those to later.
Mr. Blackburn, this is Commissioner Kobach. What exactly do you feel is advantageous to intervening as opposed to being someone who's affected by the landowner? Do you think that a voice will be squelched?
Whether or not something is advantageous to the land to a landowner is for the landowner to make a decision. It's not for me to make a decision about whether to intervene, and it's actually not for the commission to make a decision about whether a landowner should intervene or not in a proceeding. So I'm not going to try to speak for all possible landowners.
Well, I understand that. I mean, a landowner can intervene if they'd like to, but even if they don't intervene, they still have the rights as any citizen does to be a part of this. The Code of Rural Action could call them as a witness. We will take their comments. They don't necessarily have to intervene to be part of this. Do you understand it that way, or are we disagreeing on that?
Yes, I understand that there's different levels and degrees of intervention in the process. The point of notice is to allow people, to landowners and others, to understand their full legal rights under the law to participate fully in the commission's proceedings. And again, whether or not a landowner chooses to do that is for the landowner to decide. There could be a variety of reasons why landowners would choose to intervene or not to intervene. The point of notice is to allow them to have enough information to make an intelligent choice about that.
Okay. In your petition, you said several landowners. If we did grant this petition to extend the application for party status, do you anticipate hundreds, or how many people do you anticipate will intervene in the case?
I don't have any estimate of how many people would intervene in the case.
Okay. And I hope that Dakota Rural Action understands, and if they do have contact with people who would like party status, or if they don't want party status, that hopefully you will relay to them that our staff is there to help them, and also that they don't necessarily need to have party status for their voice to be heard. As far as your petition to extend the deadline, I'm still weighing that, but thank you.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, yes, go ahead.
I think it's fair for me to at least express my opinion so that Mr. Blackburn at least has an opportunity to say what he has to say. I don't wish to ambush him by making the comments after motion's been made and then preclude him from being able to make any statement. But frankly, after looking at all of the information prior to sitting down here as we study these things, I had planned on voting for the extension. I still may vote for it in spite of what the presentations that were made here today. I say that because I think Ms. Semler did an excellent job of presenting a case of why the citizens are very well represented, and she does an excellent job of representing the citizens. Mr. Blackburn basically made a two-sentence statement prior to in support of his position and, of course, what he provided to us in writing. But to basically say that on the premise that 148 people filed versus 11 people filed, therefore there has to be something wrong, you just can't make a conclusion from that, at least not an accurate one. And, you know, that's to ignore the fact that we held public hearings, public meetings at least, in three different communities that was in a number of newspapers during that period of time. Those public meetings were very well attended. A lot of questions were asked and answered, and it received coverage prior and after. During each meeting, I know that you, Mr. Chairman, on several occasions made the statement of how people could go through the intervention process, so that citizens were very, very much aware of it. There was information handed out to citizens so that they could go through that process. We have a completely different situation here than we did in the first one, where we had basically a rural water system, or at least the manager of a rural water system that literally and figuratively campaigned against the pipeline for an extended period of time and spent a great deal of time and resources of the rural water system informing people of detrimental situations, at least in his mind, that would occur. We had a seven-hour meeting as a result of that in Britain. Certainly, they're very different situations when we've gone through one and have a different. I just don't see how you can base that conclusion on that one premise. I still may vote in favor of the extension in spite of the presentation by Mr. Blackburn. My feeling is that the reason I was voting for it more than, and perhaps it's not fair to the applicant, but I just wanted to make certain that the citizens not only feel, but they have every opportunity to voice their opinion, to be a part of it, to go through this process. And like I say, that might not be fair to the applicant, but I think erring on the side of the citizens is always a good thing. I can't let this go without saying that I took offense that people's property rights were being taken away through this process. I just don't think that's accurate at all. And that during this discussion, when you were asking the pointed questions for specifics, that Mr. Blackburn instead stated that he wanted us to look into this. He just wanted to raise the question. And yet, when asked for those specifics repeatedly, could not provide any of those except for generalities. And, in fact, that is the purpose of this meeting right now, is to provide that information so that we could have those specifics. And if he, in fact, believes that exists, then he should have presented those not only verbally here today, but should have had them in writing. So it places me in a bit of a quandary from wanting to vote for this and feeling that I just absolutely should not be voting for it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Blackburn, if you have a comment, I made these statements prior to the vote so that you'd have that opportunity.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm sorry that I regret that you feel that way, that I didn't provide enough specifics. As I said, our goal was to raise the issue, and although we could have filed a motion directly to request re-notice initially, I'm not familiar with the commission's being new to the state, not familiar with the commission's procedures and process. I'm not exactly certain of how the best way to approach this was. At this point, as I said, I think the appropriate process for DRA will be to provide the motion that will answer the questions that, that you've raised and the commissioners have raised, and provide the specifics about what's required by notice and describe the law in full. I hope that that provides adequate information for you going into the future. As I said, the concern that we are trying to avoid, and we hope that you see as a positive contribution, is that should notice be defective, regardless of who raised that notice in the future, then the commission's procedures could be overturned by a court. And the commission, we suggest, should be cautious about how it changes the notice provided to landowners. And we see that our contribution here is positive in that sense. As I said, we will provide a motion to renotice, and then the commission can decide whether our arguments have merit based on a full legal briefing of the matter.
Any further questions for any party? Hearing none, I will move to comment and action. I would like to move that the commission deny the motion for extension of time, and in the alternative, grant an extension to May 31st. That would be 2 weeks from last Friday, which I think, if there are people who, still feel as though they want to get their applications in, we really do want them, and of course, even after May 31st, we'd take them. But I think that's a little bit better timeline, May 31st, rather than the pleading that asked for June 11th. So with that, we'll see if there's any discussion on the pending motion.
That gives it full 30 days then, extra.
No, the original was May 11th. My motion, which I don't know that I'm married to, but would be May 31st, which would be an additional 20 days.
Oh, I got you. And then we haven't heard. I'm sorry, this is Commissioner Kubik. Staff, we haven't had anybody else in the 9 days since the filing deadline come in?
No. We received some, like, the day after the deadline ran, and I assume they maybe mailed it on the sure. deadline day. But since the motion's been filed, no.
So that would be, I guess you could consider that to only be about 11 days that people actually think they, or after the order, 11 days, 9 days.
Well, I mean, I'll be very blunt about this, Commissioner Kolbeck. I didn't think that the request by Dakota Rural Action and Plains Justice met its burden. I don't think that they, I didn't buy the legal arguments. I didn't think that there was enough there to warrant. But that being said, I mean, I sort of pride myself on not making, small p political decisions. But in this instance, I think Commissioner Hansen is right. I do think, it never hurts to send the message to people that their voices are so valued as a part of this proceeding that we're going to, even without good reason, or at least at this point that hasn't been proven, without good reason that's been proven, we're going to go ahead and just in case give you another 11 days to make sure that if you want to get in, you can get in. I just think sending that message is the right thing to do from a dealing with the public standpoint, even if from a purely legal standpoint it doesn't meet muster. And that's a lot more blunt than, I would normally be about making a motion that isn't very strong from a legal perspective.
Do you feel that with the holiday coming up, there's any, you still feel that 11 days is adequate?
Well, if you wanted to go to June 11th, that'd be fine. I don't think it's supported by the pleading we had. And in addition, we just haven't heard that. I mean, I just think back to our first experience where we were getting individual commissioners. I mean, we're being talked to in emails and phone calls and family members in the affected area, and I've got family members in the affected area, and I'm not hearing very much, and Commissioner Hansen's got family members in the affected area. And to me, I think I'm not feeling this. People know about it. They're talking about it, but I just don't think that they're – I think the idea that people don't have that people are unaware that they could be involved, I just am not buying it. Okay. But that being said, I if you make a motion to June 11th, I mean, I'll have to make a decision up or down.
No, I think my motion would be to denied the whole thing. But I like your motion, Commissioner Johnson. I was just trying to work through the days and if 11 is adequate or I think 11 new days, if someone wanted to file an intervention, all it has to do, it does not have to be notarized, right? We went through that with the first. You don't have to have a notarized commitment from any party that wants to be party status. I'm sorry, Ms. Mamie Kara, just so we're all straight, what does party status entitle, just so that Dakota Rural Action can hear?
Well, to be a party to this docket provides an individual the right to participate at our evidentiary hearing. The individual can provide evidence. They can call witnesses. They're subject to discovery. They can also, you know, ask their own discovery questions. They're subject to participation in depositions. They could be deposed. Any legal obligation or right in any civil case, in any case. However, we also do have a rule that indicates, you know, any interested person can participate at any time as well. Sure. So up until we get down to that final evidentiary hearing, you know, there's nothing special about being an intervener.
Okay. And I do believe the application of party status does have to be notarized.
I believe it does, too. Yeah. I don't know. I don't have the rule in front of me, but the form that we use has a notary section. Therefore, I'll assume that the rule requires that.
Okay. And I guess when I had a couple things running through my mind. If a person just wanted to file comments and they just wanted to write a letter to us so that their voice is heard, that does not have to be notarized.
Not at all. And we have a variety of ways that a person can submit comments. You can submit comments and just get some answers from staff, and those don't necessarily even hit the docket. They're not public. You don't have to tell the world what you're thinking. We'll simply help you work through your questions and problems. Sure. A second way is to make public comments. Put them in the docket. The commissioners can see it, commission counsel can see it, and staff will see it. So there's really two ways to comment on this.
Sure. All right. Yeah. Again, I think Ms. Semler has really laid it out quite nicely, and 11 days, I think, would be sufficient. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other comments on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks, Mr. Blackburn, and everyone else.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Yes. Oh. Well, thanks, Commissioner Hanson, for – hold on. Mr. Blackman, were you trying to say something on the phone? Oh, thank you. Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
As long as we were recognizing long-tenured staffers, we have a just recently former staffer in the audience. Mr. Best gave a number of decades of very good service to the commission. So welcome back, Arlen. Good to have you. If we do anything wrong, you just stand up and let us know.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to point out that he moved from Pierre to the great city of Sioux Falls and within, a half a block of my house. But already he has found that neighborhood too, too lowbrow? Or So he and his lovely wife have decided to move to another part of the community. And, of course, our neighborhood will have to get along with not being quite as spit and polished and uptown as it was before. But he's at least still within the community, so we'll all benefit from it.
Thanks, Commissioner, for the pointing out Harlan as well. With that, we'll proceed to pipeline safety item number one, which deals with the filing of the Commission Pipeline Safety Program Manager for a declaratory ruling regarding whether or not a pipeline operator documentation maximum allowable operating pressure can exceed the lines in SDCL 4941B2.1 without a siting permit. But that's not the question today. The question today is, shall the Commission grant intervention to those parties that have filed? And at this time, we'll hear from any parties that have filed.
Mr. Chairman, this is Pam Bonrud with Northwestern Energy.
Go ahead, Ms. Bonrud.
We would just ask for you, respectfully request your approval of our request to intervene.
Great. Thank you, Northwestern.
Thank you.
And do you head it off at the pass? Go ahead, Mr. Gerdes.
I hesitated before I pushed the button, and that's what happens. Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, my name is Dave Gerdes. I'm a lawyer from Pierre, and I represent Montana Dakota Utilities Company in this docket. And Montana Dakota Utilities seeks intervention, and I'll stand by for questions.
Thanks very much. Anybody else have any comments? We should certainly want to hear from the Pipeline Safety Program Manager, his attorney.
This is Kara Semler speaking for both me and Nathan Solem. We really appreciate the involvement of these companies in working through this question, so we definitely support intervention.
Great, thanks very much. Any questions? Hearing none, any action?
I'll motion in PS09-002 that the Commission grant intervention to any of the parties that have filed.
Motion has been made. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen.
Aye.
Colbeck.
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much. With that, we'll move to telecom item number one, which takes in, I believe, five dockets from TC07-112 through 116. And actually, I wonder if we shouldn't take up the remainder of the telecom items first, given that this may take a little while. Any objection to that from any party or any commissioner? Hearing none, we'll proceed to telecom item number two, which is in the matter of the filing for approval of an amendment to an interconnection agreement between Quest and McLeod USA Telecommunication Services. And do either of those parties wish to make comment?
Just comments, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, for Thompson for Quest, we don't have any comments.
Okay, thank you very much. Staff, any comment?
The amendment was properly filed and executed. Staff's not concerned with any of the substance, no discriminatory language. No comments were filed. Staff recommends approval.
Thanks very much, Ms. Semler. Any questions? Hearing none, any motion?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move that the Commission approve the amendment to the agreement.
Motion has been made. No second is being required. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johns votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. We'll proceed to telecom item number three, which deals with the filing for an interconnection agreement between Quest and MCI Metro Access Transmission Services. Either of the parties wish to make comment?
Chairman, George Thompson for Quest. Again, we don't have any comments.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Ms. Semler?
Staff has the same comments for this amendment. It was properly filed and executed. No discriminatory language was noticed. No comments were filed. Staff recommends approval.
Thank you very much. Any action?
My motion in TC09-013 that the Commission approve the amendment to the agreement.
Motion having been made, is there any comment? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Telecom item number four is TC09-017. This is a filing made by Quest Corporation for approval of submission of its annual PAP payment cap calculation under Quest's performance assurance plan. And the question for the commission today is, shall it grant the approval of the PAP payment cap calculation, or in the alternative, how shall the commission proceed? We'll look toward Quest for their comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. George Thompson again for Quest. Commissioners, this request was made because Quest was successful in asking for and receiving a grant of forbearance for the ARMUS net return portion of our reports to the FCC. I'll say that particular portion of our report also formed the basis for the calculation of the cap, the annual cap on Quest performance assurance plan payments. And because we no longer have a duty to file with the FCC this particular report, that undercuts the basis for the calculation of the cap on our performance assurance plan payments. So Quest is proposing to use the last year reported, which would cap our performance assurance plan payments at the larger of $15 million or 36% of the ARMUS net return, which for the last report was $9.5 million. As a practical matter, that means that Quest cap is $50 million because that's the larger amount. We proposed this and have provided staff with our annual performance assurance plan payments over the last 3 years, which are a tiny fraction of the $15 million. As a practical matter, commissioners, Quest believes that it will never approach that cap, and so we believe our proposal is reasonable, and we'll take any questions.
Thanks very much, Mr. Thompson. Ms. LaBrie-Baker, Ms. Kramer?
Thank you, Chairman. This is Terry LaBrie-Baker with staff. I think Mr. Thompson did a good job of giving you the background information on it. Staff has reviewed the filing and feels this is probably the simplest solution in light of the recent FCC order. There were no interveners in the matter, and staff would recommend approving the cap calculation as filed.
Questions for either party? Ms. LaBrie-Baker, we don't deal with something like this very often, actually not ever anyway, in my experience. There doesn't seem to be a lot here to be nervous about. Are there unintended consequences? Are there wrinkles in this that are not readily apparent?
Based on their payments the last few years, they're not even close to hitting that cap. So I don't believe so, no.
And the calculation of that cap doesn't affect anything else down the road. That cap isn't used in some other formula or some other mechanism to calculate anything else?
Not that I'm aware of.
Mr. Thompson?
No, Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay, good. Just never want to change those numbers in the Excel spreadsheets without making real sure where they all go. So, all right, any other questions? Hearing none, any comments or action? I would move the commission grant the approval of the PAP payment cap calculation. Any comments on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Canson?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. With that, we'll proceed back to telecom item number one, which did deal with a petition for arbitration pursuant to the 96 Act to resolve issues related to interconnection between related to interconnection agreements and the dockets we mentioned earlier. A motion for, a petition for reconsideration has been made by Altel, and at this time we'll hear from Mr. Wazorek.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't intend to go very long. This commission has been very tentative during the hearing in this matter and the previous arguments. However, when the commission issued its findings and facts and conclusions of law and notice of entry of order, the commission might recall that it also requested in these dockets all but Beersford because the issue as to recip comp had been settled with Beersford to go back and come back with more information. At that time, I felt, though procedurally perhaps, I didn't have to make my motion to reconsider other facts. At that time, I felt it would be appropriate to do so and to point some things out to the commission that I had some issues with the findings, and I thought it caused some confusion and potentially weren't supported by the record. I raised three issues. The first issue will deal with all dockets but Beersford because it's a recip comp issue. And that issue deals with, I've asked the commission to reconsider the findings of facts 25 through 27 and or provide more directions to the parties. These findings dealt with the various ways to calculate costs attributable and for a factor in calculating the recip comp. You might remember it's the PATH method, the rate equivalency method, and the DS1 equivalency. The commission has decided on a rate equivalency model in its findings. The rate equivalency kind of came up right at the end. I think some rates were thrown in and rebuttal testimony of the petitioners, but then it was discussed extensively at the time of the hearing from the different experts. Altel at the hearing, as the commission notes, agreed to a rate equivalency of DS1s to DS3s, and the commission does adopt that as part of their findings, and we don't have an objection to that. Obviously, we agreed to it. Where the commission's decision is not clear and where we're asking some reconsideration where the commission just make a determination, is what is the equivalency rate for DSOs to DS1s? Now, you might recall that at the time of the hearing, petitioners had thrown in a signaling link in their rebuttal testimony. There's examination where their expert that was even bringing that forward could not even explain what a signaling link was. Altel explained that, look, a signaling link is a special link, a dedicated link, essentially takes a whole DS1, but voice traffic DS1s come in at 20 to 24 DSOs per DS1, and we thought that's the appropriate, even under the rate equivalency standard. Now, when I read the commission's decision, it does not appear to have rendered a decision on DSOs to DS1s. And that's why in my motion I said, you know, commission, either provide us some direction as to that, you want further information on that issue, or I think the commission should decide that it's that 20 DSOs to a DS1 based on the evidence at the hearing. And that's the first issue. Why Altel believes that 20 to 1 is an appropriate rate. If the commission needs more evidence on that, then I think the commission needs to provide that to us where we don't get people thinking that there's been a determination. Is it the signaling link or is it the 20 to 1? What is the commission's decision and desire? Issues 2 and 3, and I'll just deal with all three of these issues unless the commission wants to do with it, take them in a broken out order. So issue 2 deals with the inter-MTA factors, and that is findings of facts 40 and 41. And just for the commission's information, rather than try to give you every finding of fact in every docket because they differ slightly, I did provide a matrix showing each finding of fact, corresponding finding of fact that I'm discussing here. And the findings I'm citing to right now are just the McCook ones, but the matrix then provides the identical findings in each docket. In finding of fact 41, the commission rejects the Altel inter-MTA factor analysis. Essentially, throughout the findings, the only real finding that the commission makes is why it's to be rejected appears in finding 41, where it discusses Altel's revisions failed to account for all MXXs that were added as part of the Altel acquisition. If this is the determination and if that is sufficient to reject the study, the same thing has to be said for the petitioner study in that they don't account for them either. The other difficulty with that is the testimony on the intermachine trunking, which is mentioned in 40, is clear that the intermachine trunking is not used to deliver calls to petitioners except for within the state of South Dakota, and there were no MPA or NXXs in the state of South Dakota for Altel that were added because Altel didn't do business in the state of South Dakota as part of the acquisition. I think the confusion arises here is there was argument by Mr. Thompson that we ignored the Altel lines that are in Nebraska and surrounding states. However, on cross-examination, he stated, he admitted that if those are being delivered over an IXC, which they are, it doesn't make any difference anyway. So if the commission, as I read their findings, has made a determination that we failed to account for NXXs, well, if that's the grounds for rejecting our study, then I think you have to reject petitioner's study. And if on the end machine trunking, if that's a grounds for rejecting it, the testimony on the end machine trunking is it doesn't make a difference because that intermachine trunking is in state South Dakota anyway, and those numbers were Altel number were never Altel numbers because Altel didn't do business in the state. For those reasons, I think the commission needs to reconsider its findings as rejecting Altel's inter-MTA factor analysis. And finally, The last one was on findings of facts 44 and 45, and had to do with netting. Commission, essentially, as I read the order, determines netting backdoors in a long distance rate for Altel, and that netting should not be used. Netting was allowed under the intra-MTA, and we think that would be the determination for netting under inter-MTA would be appropriate as being consistent with the intra-MTA determination. And with that, I don't want to take any more of the Commission's time, so if they have questions, I would certainly entertain those.
Thank you, Mr. Rosorik. Appreciate it. Ms. Moore, comments for your clients?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Meredith Moore appearing on behalf of the petitioners in this matter. And as a preliminary comment, I had a number of managers of the petitioners in this particular docket who had wanted to be present either telephonically or personally today and who were unable to do so because of a prior meeting commitment. And so they simply wanted to indicate to the commission that they wish they had been able to be present for this particular matter to obviously indicate how important it is to them. From a procedural standpoint, Altel's motion in this particular matter, especially on the first issue, really isn't a motion to reconsider. When one looks at the particular law and rules that are in place for a motion to reconsider in the circuit court level, really the tenor of a motion to reconsider is to present new evidence or overlooked evidence or facts that essentially would give the reviewing party an opportunity to re-examine some of its findings of fact or conclusions of law. In other words, something that would seemingly indicate that perhaps that finding of fact isn't wholly accurate or wholly correct. And in that particular regard, the first issue as it relates to the development of the reciprocal compensation rate and specifically this commission's order to the parties or excuse me, to the petitioners in this matter to revise the FLEX study and to utilize the rate equivalency method as it relates to the allocation of costs, it isn't a motion to reconsider. And I would echo Mr. Wozorek's comments in that the findings of fact and conclusions of law are very extensive in this particular case and are the result of this commission having taken a tremendous amount of time to look at all of the arguments and the briefing and to arrive at the conclusions. And really, when one looks at Altel's brief in this particular matter and specifically looks at the finding of facts with which it finds fault, specifically finding of fact 24, 25, and I believe 27, those findings of fact, simply set out the various positions of the parties as it related to Altel's advocacy of the bandwidth or the DS1 equivalency method, and the petitioner's advocacy of the PATH method. And the commission, in its findings of fact and conclusions of law, makes some references to what the parties believed to be the appropriate equivalencies between DS0s, DS1s, DS3s, and so on and so forth. However, there was no specific adoption or recommendation by this commission of any of those sorts of things. And it's in that regard why I think Altel's motion to reconsider on this issue is inappropriate, because what the commission did was to order the petitioners to revise their FLEX studies to include the rate equivalency method. They've done that. We have submitted now the work papers, the study, and some supporting explanatory testimony in support of that study to Altel, so that it has an opportunity to take a look at those numbers and to analyze those numbers and to submit some responsive testimony or to ask some additional questions regarding that. However, it's not appropriate to essentially ask for further guidance at this point in time or to ask for some sort of definition from the commission as to how that rate equivalency method should work. Essentially, that's preemptively defining the parameters of the study when no study has yet been placed before the commission for its review and for an ultimate determination of whether that revised study should be accepted. and whether the rates, which are a result of that study, should be accepted. And so from that standpoint, the petitioners would ask that the commission deny Alltel's motion to reconsider or motion to essentially define what that rate equivalency method should look like, because that's not something that needs to be done at this point in time, and that's something where Alltel will certainly have an opportunity in the future to ask questions and to provide rebuttal testimony to the testimony which has now been proffered by the petitioners in support of that rate equivalency method, and to somehow put some sort of artificial parameters in place at this juncture, I think defeats the ultimate purpose and may ultimately tie the parties up in knots before anyone has had a real opportunity to examine this revised FLEX study. As it relates to Alltel's second and third issues as defined in its petition to reconsider, I would submit to the Commission that the extensive findings of fact and conclusions of law that are in place address all of the arguments that Alltel originally made and all of the arguments that Alltel now makes in regard to why the Commission erred on its decision as it relates to the specific inter-MTA factor that should be utilized by each of the petitioners, as well as whether netting should be allowed to Alltel. And when one specifically looks back at the Commission's findings of fact and conclusions of law, specifically findings of fact 39 through 41, it's clear that this Commission acknowledged Alltel's arguments with regard to the proposed petitioners. There are specific things in there that reference changes in the network were attributable to divestitures and acquisitions, cell site rehoming, and changes implementing MTA routing in its switch translations group. And as one goes on to finding fact 41, the Commission specifically indicated that it believed Alltel had presented evidence of only those network changes which were advantageous to its position and failed to present sufficient evidence that its changes that it proposed at the time of the hearing should have been made to the petitioner's SS7 studies. So I think in that regard, again, Alltel has not brought forth any new evidence or any overlooked evidence which would justify this commission's reexamination or rewriting of those findings of fact and conclusions of law as it relates to the inter-MTA factor and to the commission's final decision in that particular regard. The fact of the matter is this commission sits in a position where it has the opportunity to hear all of the evidence, to judge the credibility of the witnesses, and to make determinations as to what testimony and what evidence it chooses to accept and what evidence and testimony it chooses to reject. And that's exactly what it did when it looked at what inter-MTA factor should be adopted for each of these petitioners and whether netting should be adopted. And so, therefore, Alltel has not met its burden when it comes to making an effective argument that this commission should essentially reconsider or overrule its prior decision. So, therefore, the commission or the petitioners would ask that the commission deny Alltel's motion for reconsideration on all respects and allow the findings of fact and conclusions of law to stand as currently written. Thank you.
Ms. Kramer.
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. Staff would recommend denial of the petition for reconsideration on all three issues. However, if the commission, you know, as to issue one, wishes to provide guidance as Mr. Ozarek requested, I think you could do that here. I don't think it's necessary, and staff's recommendation would simply be to wait until the hearing. I believe that's scheduled now in the first week in August or something. But I think you have the latitude to do that should you wish to. But otherwise, staff would recommend denying the petition for reconsideration.
Thanks, Ms. Kramer. Any questions for any party? Mr. Wazorek, I'll I'll dive in with regard to your issue two. You know, I struggle with this one maybe more than any other issue. I mean, given the dynamic nature of a network, I mean, doesn't the commission just have to pick the data before it that it felt best represented reality? I mean, if we continue to talk about that this may be better or that another study might be better or make these adjustments, I mean, this docket could go on forever, couldn't it?
I understand that everything's fluid in this industry. I'd like to address your question first by kind of addressing something that Ms. Moore said. Now, reconsideration.
And Mr. Rosenberg, just to interrupt, I should have given you a rebuttal. So after you answer my question, feel free to take a few moments to rebut anything you like.
Well, let me just, in the way reconsideration is handled in cases I've always been in circuit court is, look, if I think there's an issue with the findings of facts not lining up with the evidence, you bring it up to the trial court before you appeal it, and that's traditionally how reconsideration is. And that's why in that number two issue, I'm pointing out to the commission essentially, look, if in your conclusion, I agree with Ms. Moore, you talk about the different things going on, but if your conclusion, the reason you're dismissing the Alltel determination, which it appears to me is the NXX issue, well, that issue is consistent with petitioner's study has the same issue. It needs to be remembered that, you know, petitioners did this study in 2004, pre-merger. They chose not to do an update on it, even though it was obvious the network had had substantial changes. And so Alltel essentially gets punished for coming in and say, hey, we've changed our network, and their study is thrown out, yet a study that's clearly acknowledged by everybody as being before the merger with Alltel and before all these changes, and even done prior to 2 years prior to the interconnection agreement. It was done during the old interconnection agreement, had a couple years left on it, is the valid study that didn't take into consideration anything, yet the study that took into consideration the change in the network is no good. So I can appreciate the commission gets studies laid out in front of it. I can appreciate that networks are fluid. But if the commission's determination is, you know, Alltel, we can't rely on your study because when the network changed, you didn't take account for NXXs, which I believe as the record shows that that's a non-issue for our study, given the way the merger was. And that's why I think that's a mistake of a fact for the commission to determine. But if that's the determination that you didn't account for changes in the network, the petitioners didn't do any of it. So that's why I think this is ripe for reconsideration. Now, just taking the liberty that the chairman gave me to address Ms. Moore's information. I want to drop to issue one, if I could, just for a moment. When I read the commission's decision, I think the commission's decision, when it sent us back to do studies, didn't provide a lot of direction. And if that's the commission's choice, that's certainly fine. Obviously, Alltel had stipulated to the 7-to-1 ratio DS1s to DS3s. My concern, and the reason I wanted the commission to either apply some clarification or give us a ruling that the 20 DSOs to 1 DS1 was correct, is that only removes one factor. And I've been doing this long enough and dealing with these arbitrations that I could see that if the commission did not either provide some direction saying we want some information and justification for what you think that factor needs to be for DSOs to DS1s, or make that determination that it's a 20-to-1 as I've asked the commission to do, that what you're going to get, and I'll tell you, I don't want to get into the testimony that's been submitted, but all you got was petitioner is just assuming 2-to-1 on DSO to DS1s. Now, if that's what the commission wants when they get to hearing, then don't, you know, if it's just wide open and people come in at risk, then people come in at risk. But I also don't want to get in a situation where we move down where there's a bunch of information submitted at the end because there was some confusion as to what the commission wanted. So with that, and if there's more questions, I'd certainly respond.
So, Mr. Wazurek, at this point, I mean, I'll be quite honest. I mean, I don't know that I have enough information in the record or in my own life experiences to make a determination that 20-to-1 is the right ratio. I mean, you sort of started your comments today by indicating that perhaps the commission should ask for additional information. Do you believe there are efficiencies gained by asking for that information here? I won't call it on the front end. We're way too deep into this sausage to call it the front end, but prior to the hearing dates in August.
Well, and that's the problem, and that's why in that issue number one I said, look, I think there's sufficient evidence for you to make a determination that's 21, but if not, let's just clarify that you want more information on what that rate should be, because I think the parties should be providing testimony as what that ratio should be, and we shouldn't get to that hearing and have somebody, a witness, say, oh, I just assumed it was 2-to-1 because you had adopted our 7-to-1 on the DS1 to DS3s. And I don't think that was the commission's determination. The commission didn't make a determination. But I've been doing this long enough to know that you're going to get that assumption. And I think that's been held out throughout the testimony the first round was submitted.
So if we're going to have that fight, I mean, if we're going to hear that debate, if the commission's going to have to make that decision because it's reasonable to presume the parties won't be able to come to an agreement, are there efficiencies to be gained in having that information filed prior to August, or does it just make sense to have it all out in August?
Well, no, what I'm saying, Commissioner, is if you're not going to make that determination that I've asked you on our evidence, then all I'm asking the commission to say, look, somebody's going to have to prove that up. We're going to pick that rate, and we're going to pick it on additional evidence, whatever that ratio is. We didn't make that determination, and because I think you don't want us to show up in August with one side saying, I just thought it was 2-to-1, and the other side saying, no, here's a bunch of information, or what you do is you get deluged with a bunch of information from the side that thought was 2-to-1 at the last second because they didn't know his issue.
So when's the optimum time? And if we don't want to do it then, if we just don't want to show up in August and do it, I mean, does it really matter if we do it 2 weeks before that, you know, through some paper filings? Do we really gain anything, I guess, is what I'm trying to figure out.
Well, I guess what I think you gain is that as a lawyer, sometimes you're in these difficult situations where I can't just come up to the commission and go, hey, could you give me a little bit better direction on what you want here? And that's why you make these motions. But I think if the commission wants evidence on what is the appropriate ratio for DS1s or DSOs to DS1s, because in your decision, I don't see anywhere where you made that conclusion. You just talked about the different parties' discussions. But under this rate equivalency, what's the appropriate? Then I think the commission say, we want evidence on that in the pre-filed testimony. So when we get here in August, we don't have a bunch of people saying, oh, we don't have a bunch of stuff coming at the last second, and we don't have fresh testimony as to what that should be that nobody's had a chance to even think about.
Okay, I've got you now. I'm tracking. I've got a few, but I'll do one more, and then I'll turn it over, and we can round-robin this a little bit. Ms. Moore, I wanted to give you an opportunity to refute the concerns Mr. Wazurek raised with regard to, I'm talking issue two now, I'm talking studies, and he raised an inner machine trunk issue and a failure to account for all NXXs, that component is a weakness of both studies. Enlighten us a bit here on your views.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. As an initial matter, there's always going to be a dispute over which proposed study should ultimately be accepted. There's always going to be competing viewpoints on that particular issue. And this commission is ultimately vested with the authority to make a determination as to which study carries greater weight or has greater credibility. And I think if one looks back at the transcript of this particular matter, and specifically Mr. Thompson's testimony, and there were a significant number of questions posed, if I recall correctly, by both staff, commission counsel, as well as commissioners on the SS7 study, the age of the SS7 study, the factors that were included in that, and the network elements that were included in that. And Mr. Thompson provided testimony on all of those issues, including the NPA NXX, including the intermachine trunking, and also talked about Altel's failure to include a number of changes in its own network when it did its study. And so ultimately what you return to is the competing study. And I think what history, not only in this particular matter, but in also in some of the other matters that have been presented to this commission and other dockets, what history has taught us is that there needs to be an ultimate determination made as to what type of study will be used and when or what snapshot in time should be used in order to support that study. Because otherwise what we are going to have is a constantly evolving study and one where either side will always be able to make some sort of argument to refute one particular fact versus another, and that does nothing as far as resolving the ultimate inter-MTA factor or ensuring that the parties actually have one, because I think one of the things that came up at the time of the hearing was whether the inter-MTA factor should be subject to readjustment, whether that be on a regular interval basis or whether it be every year or something along those lines. And the testimony and the evidence was presented was essentially that it needed to be a factor for the duration of the agreement simply because of the past workings between these two parties and the fact that there never was a readjustment achieved when there should have been one. And so from that standpoint, when one looks back at the testimony and the evidence, and when one looks at the findings of fact and conclusions of law that were issued by the commission on the inter-MTA issue, you can find the record sites, you can find the specific references to the testimony, and it shows that the commission took all of Altel's arguments into consideration, specifically with regard to the intermachine trunking. And I think that finding of fact 41 specifically indicates that while that argument may have been somewhat in Altel's favor, it certainly took into it certainly ignored other arguments or other factors which would have been in the petitioner's favor. And I think Mr. Thompson's testimony acknowledged that. And ultimately, I think what the commission did here was it took all of those things into consideration and arrived at the best result that it could have. And I don't think that there are any facts that were specifically ignored by the commission, nor was there anything that essentially held the petitioners to a lower burden of proof than what Altel was. The commission simply looked at all of the facts and made the determination that the petitioner's study better accounted for what was there and provided the degree of finality that's needed here.
Other questions? Then maybe while other folks get their notes put together,
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go ahead, Ms. Moore.
I apologize, and I appreciate I already had an opportunity to speak, but may I have permission to respond to your earlier question to Mr. Wazorek about the efficiencies that might be created by either having the commission issue some sort of further instruction to the parties on the nature of the testimony to be received before hearing in this matter?
Sure. Maybe I'll tee it up just for a little bit for you, Ms. Moore. I mean, I'm starting to see some benefit to what Mr. Wazorek has requested in requesting that all parties provide some evidence, pre-filed testimony to that effect. Why is he wrong on that front?
I don't think he's wrong on that front as it as it relates to providing pre-filed testimony to explain the study, to explain what was done, and in order to support the petitioner's burden of proof as to the revised FLEX study. However, I think where we're getting a little crosswise here is as it relates to Altel's particular position on this issue. I think one of the problems that I see with Altel's argument in support of establishing some sort of equivalency rates up front is that we're looking backward ultimately to what Altel proposed at the outset of this matter, which was the DS1 equivalency or the bandwidth method. And it's presuming or it's trying to establish a presumption that we have to establish all these equivalencies between DS0s, DS1s, DS1s, DS3s, so on and so forth in advance of actually seeing what the rate equivalency method is. Ultimately, admittedly, and as this commission pointed out in its findings of fact and conclusions of law, the petitioners bear the burden of proof on this particular matter. And I think contrary to Altel's claims that the commission sent everyone back to the drawing board without guidance, there was specific guidance to define the rate equivalency method or to produce a study, I should say, that conforms with the rate equivalency method. And a definition of that method was offered at the time of the hearing. And to essentially insert now some new parameters into that really doesn't allow the petitioners to present their testimony on the rate equivalency method. Now, if there's something that can be done through discovery, if there's something that can be done through testimony in order to work out these issues, that's certainly something that can be put into place through a scheduling order or otherwise. But I think to preemptively define these parameters, I think is a dangerous move because it's presuming things that aren't yet before the commission, and so it doesn't allow everyone an opportunity to explain how things work, to explain how things should go, and frankly, I think it could be, it could create an even bigger mess than perhaps where we're, than perhaps anything that what we would ever intend to be in that position. And I appreciate your consideration there and willingness to allow me to respond to that.
So we'll see if there are other questions. Mr. Islov, did you have something?
I don't have any questions. I would have a response on what the rate equivalency method means to me anyway in having to review it. Frankly, I think in every issue in the hearing, the parties had to provide justification for whatever recommendation they had. I think the order spoke to the rate equivalency method to the extent it appeared in the record. And I think as we go to hearing, I think I appreciate this, and I would suspect your attorney, Rolaine Wiest, appreciates as much information as we can as it relates to the party proving their case, the parties proving their case. I find it somewhat odd at this point that I'm going to be defining the parameters of the rate equivalency method, given that the parties have an opportunity to present whichever case they choose before the commission as long as it complies with the commission's directive to follow a rate equivalency method, which at this point we've not decided, or the commission has not decided, what is or is not appropriate within the rate equivalency method, and I think the order was illustrative of what was in the record as far as the discussion on the rate equivalency method. I don't know if that's clear, but at least that's my position as I assist the commission reviewing this issue post-hearing.
Thanks, Mr. Islov. Other questions, comments, Commissioner?
I guess I just have a comment. I think that both parties have a blank slate here, and they need to present evidence to answer the question. I'd like for them to come up with their own rate and then justify it, and not to just say, or an evidence to dismiss the other party's claims instead of just dismissing them. The record's very hard to get through. I think we've all agree on that. But to come up with these factors and to determine them is one thing, but I hope that the parties don't feel that the commission should come up with the rate. The parties need to come up with the rate, and then the commission needs to decide on the evidence how at the rate, if they've come up with the correct rate. I think at some point you start high and then try to bargain low, and the other end start low and come into an agreement. I'd rather just see the rate that they feel and the rate that is justified come out of it.
Chairman Johnson, if I may, I'll put it on the record right now. I'll speak for me. I appreciate any work the parties have done, and the more explanation they provide, the better. I'm more than willing to read, and the idea of pre-filing testimony, or at least providing as much evidence as they feel necessary, is a welcome thing from my point of view.
Ms. Moore, let's get back to finding of fact 41. We'll double back a little bit. And I understand what you're saying, but, you know, as we look at finding of fact 41, I mean, do you have any concern that, you know, the second sentence from the bottom notes that a failure to account for all the annexes, that's really the reason that the commission rejects Altel's proposed revisions? I mean, if that is a weakness in both studies, is finding of fact 41 written the right way, in your opinion?
And if you'll bear with me one moment, Commissioner, so that I can find my spot in the findings of fact. Mr. Chairman, in response to your question, I think that finding of fact 41 does explain essentially the testimony that was offered and the criticisms that were offered by the petitioners of Altel's study as well as Altel of the petitioner's study. And I think if one looks back to the preceding findings of fact as well, you likely get the better picture of the various concerns of both parties as to what should have been taken into consideration, what may have been, what was not taken into consideration. And if I recall correctly, I do believe that one of the primary areas of cross-examination of Mr. Thompson was as it related to the NXXs and to the inner machine trunks. And I think both of those concerns are explained in findings of fact 39, 40, and 41. And so from that standpoint, I don't think that there is anything in the record that was overlooked, ignored, or would lead anyone to believe that those findings of fact are clearly erroneous or are not supported by evidence in the record. To the contrary, I think there's ample evidence in the record to support that. So I don't have a concern that finding of fact 41 is inaccurate or in any way is lacking as far as finding the requisite support in the record to uphold the commission's decision on the issue.
Okay, thanks very much. Other questions? Mr. Wazorek, I wanted to give you an opportunity to respond to Mr. Islov, Commissioner Kolbeck's comments about, let's get some more information in the record. Pre-filed testimony, I think, is kind of what I was hearing, but I don't know that they are looking to make any sort of a formal request. Does your client get what they want if we were to follow the Rizlov approach?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate what they said, and I can essentially live with Mr. Rizlov said. That's the commission's desire. A couple things. This issue one, I think, has been misconstrued somewhat. I face a situation where the format under which we are submitting testimony is petitioners file our reply, and then they file a final rebuttal round. The order as it sits, as I read it and as I hear what Mr. Rizlov says, is, hey, we didn't make it, the commission didn't make in this order a determination of what the rate equivalency is on the DS1s and DSOs. However, and the parties essentially stipulated as to DS1s to DS3s in the record. I have no issue with that and with that clarification. The difficulty I faced when I read your order was I was unclear as to whether there was a rate equivalency determination on the DSO DS1 issue, and that's why if you look at this issue one, I asked for either, you know, make it clear that it should be 21 or tell us that, no, we need more evidence. Now, the problem I face and which I was trying to avoid is the fact that I will now submit my reply testimony providing my analysis on that DSO DS1 rate equivalency, having never seen testimony in this round as the justification of a DSO DS1 from petitioners, but I'll see it in rebuttal, and I won't have a chance to respond to it.
So, Ms. Rizorek, remind me of the procedural schedule. I don't have it in front of me. I mean,
we don't have a formal procedural schedule. We had tentatively agreed on a format thought to match what we had done last summer. Petitioners go we had agreed kind of on a format that petitioners would file, would file reply, they had filed rebuttal, and you know, we haven't formally adopted it, so maybe I can deal with that issue of this testimony in setting a format, and I'll try to deal with that to make sure that I don't show up at the hearing needing to put a whole bunch of new evidence in to respond to something that I saw first in rebuttal.
Well, and if it makes your ability to discuss that with other parties any easier, I'll just say, I mean, from one commissioner speaking, I do agree that I'd like some information, I'd like some specificity to be applied toward a discussion about how the rate equivalency method was developed and implemented as a part of the new calculations, and that I would want your client to be able to review that information, or at least some of that, to understand where that specificity comes from prior to in enough time so that you'd be able to make some comment prior to the hearing. Took me a long time to get that out, and I don't know that I said it right, but I think you all understand where I'm headed anyway. Other questions or comments? Ms. Wiest, would you shed some light on any of this?
This is Rolaine. With respect to the first issue, then, I guess from this point, I don't know if what would be best if the petitioners would supplement their testimony to address that issue prior to Altel filing responsive testimony. I'd like to hear from Ms. Moore on that.
Sure, Ms. Wiest. I think supplementation at this point would prove to be a little difficult because, to be perfectly honest, I still have a concern with the position that Altel is advocating on this particular issue, and it seems to me they're suggesting that the parties have reached some sort of a stipulation that there are certain DS0s to DS1s and all those sorts of things, and that stipulation was reached with the intent that those same types of parameters would apply to the rate equivalency method. I think ultimately what happened at the time of the hearing is that there was some agreement between the parties on some issues, which is somewhat hard to believe when one looks at the record here, but that wasn't necessarily intended to extend to the rate equivalency method. And I would concur with the commissioner's comments and Mr. Rizlov's comments and Mr. Wazorik's comments in that we certainly don't intend to proceed with a hearing by ambush or anything along those lines, because that's simply going to prolong this process even further and make it more untenable for everyone involved, most certainly the petitioners. And from that standpoint, the petitioners provided Altel the revised flex study, the work papers, and some supporting testimony. We have attempted to supplement the previous discovery that was propounded upon the petitioners such that Altel can take a look at that, ask any additional discovery questions if they want, and then reply to the testimony. And I know Mr. Wazorik's had an expert witness who's been tied up in some other matters and wasn't going to be available until, I believe, mid-May or later than that. And then also Mr. Williams, I know, wasn't available immediately either. So I know he's still looking at examining some of those issues. But I'm not sure at this point in time what the petitioners can supplement without having a better idea as to whether Altel's going to propose any additional discovery or what its particular position is. Because I think, again, we run the risk of essentially getting off topic, if you will. And, again, we acknowledge that we have the burden here and have produced a study, intend to support that study with evidence, with explanation, and ultimately propose a rate and explain that that rate is properly supported. So I think within the confines of the informal agreement that we've reached with Mr. Wazorek as to what can be done, I think we can properly outline that and address those concerns, and I'm certainly willing to work with Mr. Wazorek on what needs to be taken care of.
Well,
I apologize because I'm not sure that fully answers your question, but I'm not in a good position without talking with my experts who have provided that supplemental testimony at this point as to what they could even do to supplement in light of Mr. Wazorek's concerns.
So, Mr. Wazorek, do you think you could work with Ms. Moore on this issue and hopefully come to some sort of resolution?
I can certainly attempt to. I want the commission to be clear as to what I said, though. Clearly, I think there was a stipulation as to what the rate equivalency was between DS3s and DS1s. The commission, in its findings, I think, has adopted that number. However, the difficulty becomes, I think she could clearly supplement to explain and provide evidence as to what rate equivalency they've used for DSOs to DS1s. And that's, and I mean, she could either do that, and Ms. Weist, or I could provide an extra rebuttal round for Altel at the back end if she provides, if she ever does explain or provide anything beyond what they provided in the original record for their rate equivalency to DSOs and DS1s. But I just, my primary motion, my primary concern with issue one was I don't want to get to the hearing and have it be in a situation where there was an argument that the commission had somehow adopted the rate equivalency of 2-to-1 for DSOs to DS1s, or that there'd be a lot of evidence coming in at the last second because the issue wasn't addressed early on. And I can certainly work with Ms. Moore on that.
Well, then I would just recommend that the parties work together and try to address this. And if they can't work it out, I think what will happen is that the commission will probably be faced with deciding some of this later on, and that could be in the form of allowing Altel an additional round of testimony to reply if it's not worked out, and depending on the arguments that are made at that point. Going to the other issues, I guess my problem with issue two is that I didn't think that the petitioners really specifically addressed the issues that were brought up, and I would have liked to have seen more citations to the record and stuff with respect to that issue, and I think that you kind of brought that up, the chairman. Issue three, I don't think the commission needs any additional information on that issue.
Other comments or questions or action? Commissioner Kolbeck, maybe I'll break these into three just in the event we want to do something a little different. But with regard to the motion to reconsider for issue one, I think it sounds as though the parties are willing to work together on that. So I think it probably makes sense to deny the motion at this time, and I would so move. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With regard to issue number two, this is the most complex one, but I still don't know that it makes sense to reconsider the issue. I think the findings of fact were as good as they could be given the record we were dealing with. I would move to deny the motion to reconsider on issue two. Any discussion?
Well, I agree with you on this one. It is probably the most diverse, but if there's less intermachine trunking now or MPAs are at stake, right? I just don't think that the burden was met on this either.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Finally, with regard to the third issue raised by Altel, I would move the commission deny the motion to reconsider. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Did I miss anything? Okay. Thanks to the parties. With that, I think we are also at the end of our agenda. I'll pause to make sure that's the case. And if not, I would again thank Mr. Jacobson for his years of service and call everyone's attention to the announcements at the end of the agenda. Thank you, and we'll stand adjourned.